Okay, I think we should probably start as it's now past 6:30 and we have quite a full programme this evening. Welcome to this event, which is organised by LSE Ideas, and it's wonderful to be here to sort of help preside over the launch of a sort of significant volume, both in terms of content but also in terms of size. It's also good to see many of the contributors in the audience. What I'm going to do is, in a sense, keep my role as short and sweet as possible, because we've got several people who are much more interesting to listen to and who have engaged much more in much greater detail with the book than I have. So I'm going to basically just introduce people and then let the speakers speak and then open it up to a Q&A. I am meant to announce, though, that there is a Twitter hashtag for this event, which is #FCOCommerce. So others who know what Twitter is can use that. Okay, so the running order tonight is that we're going to start off with a set of comments from Professor Keith Hamilton first. We're then going to pass on to a further set of interventions from James Ellison, then John Fisher, then Effie Padaliu, and then finally Richard Smith. So that's the approved running order this evening. Each person is going to sort of try and keep to their time, and then hopefully we'll have scope to open it up to a Q&A afterwards. But without further ado, if I can pass over to you straight away, Keith, to start us off.
Okay, well, I think I ought to begin by just saying congratulations to the editors, really, for producing such a large tome. Congratulations also, I think, on your impeccable timing. When Effie Padaliu first emailed me, I think it was about 5 years ago, to say that she was thinking of getting together a group of people to produce a book on commercial diplomacy, I could hardly have guessed that we would be launching it on the eve of Britain's embarking on what are currently billed as the most important commercial negotiations we've engaged in since the Second World War. So, good for you.
It was not by design.
I've got to say, for a start, that I've myself only ever really dabbled in the history of commercial diplomacy. But I'm reading some of the chapters. I think particularly John Fisher's chapter on the de Bunsen mission to South America during the First World War. It's reminded me, really, of something that I did become engaged in way back in 2012. And that was at a time when I was then working as a consultant historian in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. We were about to publish, a group of, PUSD files, that's Permanent Undersecretary's Department files, Secret Service files, and Richard was one of us. We were engaged in writing up little pieces to draw the press's attention to these released Secret Service files. And I chose to do what looked like about the shortest thing, partly because I was engaged in writing something else at the time, partly because I knew I was coming up anyway to final retirement. And I chose to write about a little bit of commercial diplomacy in Buenos Aires. This was the centenary exhibition that the Argentinians decided to stage in 1910 to celebrate 100 years of Argentine independence. Now, the British legation in Argentina and in Buenos Aires was headed by a man called Walter Townley, very keen that Britain should have a big part to play in this exhibition. Edward Grey, the Foreign Secretary, was persuaded to send a British special representative to the exhibition, the Times correspondent in Buenos Aires, Charles Akers. And eventually Britain got a stand in the exhibition and, in fact, won a diploma for it. But the important thing about it was that this exhibition raised the whole question about British commerce in Argentina. Now, Britain was, at that stage, was Argentina's main trading partner. It was the country that had the highest level of investments there. But as Townley was to point out, Britain's share of investment, Britain's share of trade in Argentina was under threat. From the one hand, from the Americans, and from the other hand, from the Germans and other Europeans. The Americans were up to all kinds of tricks, you know, usually stressing the Pan-American side of all this, pushing their exports. And the Germans, well, what could you expect of them? Up to all their sorts of dastardly tricks, advertising their goods in Spanish, for instance, using metric measurements, undermining British commerce all over. So Townley was very anxious that things should go well, and he wanted to invest a lot in the exhibition. I say they did get a diploma for it, but that wasn't the end of the matter. Townley thought what was really needed was a British week at the end of the exhibition in November 1910, and he wanted money to stage a ball. In fact, he went round telling everybody in Buenos Aires that he was going to put on a big ball in one of the exhibition halls. He got in touch with the Foreign Office in London. Could he have some money to pay for this? And the Foreign Office got back and said, well, we can let you have £300. He wanted 1,000 or 3,000. He told everybody there was going to be a ball, but couldn't afford to put it on. And there were awful stories about the Germans were sending a Hohenzollern prince. What was to happen? Well, luckily, Townley was very lucky. He knew that Britain itself had a German princeling of their very own. In fact, there are several. And fortunately, one of them, Francis of Teck, the brother of the Queen, died in October 1910. The court went into mourning, and the British no longer had to put it on the ball. It was the end of the matter. I'd also add that in all this that Townley and Akers were also very disturbed about the fact that the lacklustre side of British business diplomacy there, the fact that British businessmen were not making a particularly skilled job of selling their wares in Argentina. Now, that's not the end of the story, because when I'd finished this little piece, I sent it off to an old colleague of mine who was, at that time, in charge of, or responsible, rather, for British territories, overseas territories south of the equator. So he was in constant touch with Buenos Aires. And he then emailed my piece to the British Embassy in Buenos Aires. He cut back the answer, which was very simply, "So it was forever thus. Does anything ever change?" Now, of course things change, but what changes? And what were they referring to as never changing? Was it the lacklustre performance of British businessmen? Their lack of marketing skills? Or was it a parsimonious treasury at home that couldn't afford to provide the money to put on a ball in Buenos Aires? And reading some of these pieces in this book, I must say that I do feel there's an echo of those same complaints in one form or another. I'm thinking of what both Simon Smith and Richard Smith have written in their own ways on this subject. That is to say that in their chapters dealing with British sales in the Middle East during the 1960s and 1970s, British business there, one can see the same problems very often. An absence of money for staff in missions abroad, for commercial staff that is, at the same time very often an inability of British firms to ensure the prompt delivery of goods and services. In that respect, as I say, very often there is in this book echoes of those problems of Buenos Aires in 1910. Now, we all know that the Plowden, the Duncan, the Beryl reports of the 1960s and 70s all stress the importance of commercial diplomacy and of the Foreign Office and later the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the FCO, giving priority to those subjects, particularly the Beryl report. Indeed, I think you can say that by the 1970s, the balance of payments was as much a preoccupation of British governments as the balance of power ones had been. And so, in a sense, you do begin to see that fresh emphasis on that, on trade and on commercial diplomacy at that time. But it's also true that throughout much of the 19th and the 20th century, British embassies, legations and consulates had all been engaged in commercial diplomacy of one kind or another, either gathering up information, gathering up intelligence, economic intelligence of one kind or another. I'm thinking perhaps if I've only recently been doing some research on the activities of the Foreign Office librarian during the 19th century. From the 1820s onwards, the Foreign Office librarian was publishing a whole series of volumes called Herzlet's Commercial Treaties. Herzlet was his name. And indeed, it's notable that in 1883, Edward Herzlet, again editing the volume, defending his volumes against Treasury cuts, was to write in 1 minute that the volumes he was publishing included every treaty concluded between the British and foreign government. He added in parentheses, brackets after that, except the political ones. The point he was making, I think, really in any way, is that the vast work of diplomacy in the 19th century and into the 20th century was very largely commercial. That's why, in some respects, I've always had those little doubts about those people who talk about aristocratic disdain for diplomacy in the office. Now, Thomas Otter, in the first chapter after the introduction in this volume, deals very well, I think, with one important division of the Foreign Office in the 19th century, notably the commercial department. He too makes the point in there that there was very often a priority given to political matters over commercial. He points too to certain elements of aristocratic disdain, if you like, towards dealing with commercial matters. Roger Carrick, later on in the final chapter in this book, writing about current practices, also talks about advice given to him by his head of mission at one stage, not to dirty his hands with commercial affairs. There is that sense then that perhaps commerce might be regarded as the poor relation of diplomacy. And yet, on the other hand, I rather suspect that the real reason for this lies much more in the fact that very often corporate interests could not easily be reconciled with what governments chose to be national interests. The two did not naturally and do not naturally go together. Support for commerce does not inevitably flow from what might be defined as the national interest. And that's apparent too in two chapters in the book, one by Fiona Venn and another by Francesco Petrini, both dealing with oil diplomacy, in which, in many ways, the interests of oil companies and the interests of the Foreign Office are not always easily the same. I might add, too, and this is a personal piece of research I was engaged in at one stage, if I look at, for instance, looking, for instance, at British trade in the Ottoman Empire before the First World War, British merchants in Constantinople in 1910, 1911 were very, very angry and very annoyed about the fees they were having to pay for docking in the docks at Constantinople. They sought the help of the British government to get these fees down, unaware of the simple fact that the Foreign Office had secretly purchased the Constantinople Keys Company, the company that ran the docks. They purchased it with Secret Service money. It was a secret deal done through the Bank of England. And it had been intended primarily to contain or to limit German economic influence in the Ottoman Empire. And that brings me on to another point. The extent to which commerce and investment may be used to serve political ends. It's not just a matter then of supporting commerce, supporting or promoting trade. It may also be a matter of using it deliberately for political purposes. Gaynor Johnson, in a chapter in here on relations with Germany in the 1920s, brings together, for instance, the whole question of the degree to which reparations and tariffs on trade were linked. Likewise, you've got the extent to which fostering trade with the empire, as it were, was seen as a way of bringing about closer imperial bonds. And so likewise, Angelo Romano, in another chapter on the 1970s, deals with trade in Britain's policy of détente, trying to foster trade, or assuming that by fostering trade you might bring about East-West trade, one might contribute to a policy of détente. And then there's another matter. The book is, of course, intended to focus on commerce in the making and application of British foreign policy. But several of the essays go far beyond the question of what I would regard as commerce. They go on to finance, to investment. They are, in many ways, not about commercial diplomacy, but about economic diplomacy. A much wider sphere, I think, but one I think which is quite a natural area to go into. And in this context, I'd like to refer to one person who only gets one mention in the book. That's Victor Wellesley. Now, Victor Wellesley was, during the First World War, he was controller of the Foreign Office's commercial and consular affairs. But he did draw up a paper at the end of the First World War, 30th of November 1918, one day off 99 years ago. A very nice paper, very, very long paper as well. Not quite as long as this book, but nonetheless quite a long paper, in which he went over what he saw as the economic origins of the war. It was a distinctly quasi-Marxist interpretation, actually. I suppose what one might expect from the grandson of the first Earl Cowley, but unless it was. Can I just read two little remarks he makes in there aloud? One is this starting paragraph. The one outstanding feature in foreign affairs at the present day is that the economic factor regulates the political atmosphere in all countries and dominates international relations. The one outstanding feature of the Foreign Office is that it is not constituted on lines that are calculated to deal with the economic aspects of foreign affairs. He subsequently added, though in a military sense the war is over, the struggle for economic supremacy overseas is only about to begin. In that struggle, we shall have no allies, but only enemies. Final victory in this war will rest with those nations who are best organised. 5 years before Hitler published Mein Kampf. Now, one of Wellesley's things, Wellesley was concerned primarily with was the organisation of the office itself. He thought about parallel commercial departments, parallel to the geographical divisions of the office. But, of course, there were other ways of organising commerce and organising commercial diplomacy. I think, Miklos Lajos' piece chapter in here deals with the Department of Overseas Trade in those years. But organisation, I think, has always been that essential problem. How do you administratively organise commercial diplomacy? And I think with the globalisation of the domestic, that's to say almost every domestic department of government having, as it were, a global aspect to what it does, that becomes increasingly difficult. I think there is really where the central question here in this book really is, and one that does need to be addressed. Where do you place the ultimate responsibility for not making commercial foreign policy, but rather for coordinating the conduct of that foreign policy, the practice of that policy, the way it is implemented? Does it lie with the Foreign Office or with other various departments of government? Where do we stand today when we now have a Department of International Trade? And I might add, too, in my own more recent researches, I've come across, too, these turf wars between the Foreign Office and other departments in this respect. One in particular, can I just speak about briefly? I'll try some. I was involved in writing about the Know-How Fund, Britain's technical assistance programme to Eastern Europe. That produced endless conflict, both within the office and without the office, over who should say what and do what. It was a programme that was political, but which aimed at the economic regeneration of Eastern Europe, or rather assisting that, at transforming the economies of the East. It therefore did involve relations between governments and industry, governments and business. And yet it had to be put, the Foreign Office had to work for what initially was a subdivision of the office, the Department of Overseas Development, the Overseas Development Administration, later on what became the Department for International Development. It was a clash of cultures between those who saw aid as an objective, as an end in itself, and those who believed it ought to serve a political purposes. That clash became even worse when DFID became an independent department in 1997. Might just one little quote here. It rose because there was a dispute inside DFID in 1998 about a new country strategy paper for Russia. And this had a cover on it, a rather nice glossy cover that was designed by somebody in DFID and which displayed a Union Jack and a Russian tricolour. And the superior of the designer immediately called him up and said, "Look, take that bloody flag off." Minuting, "We have invested much time and effort in persuading the FCO that the Know-How Fund is no longer there to fly the British flag." I wonder what Priti Patel would have made of that. Now, lastly, I just sort of wanted to make just one thing I recall. When I was a postgraduate student here at the LSE in 1964, one of the things I discovered looking through some files in the old public record office over in Chancery Lane in those days was a rather nice little record of a conversation that took place between two very aristocratic individuals. Bernhard von Bülow, who was at that time the State Secretary in the German Foreign Office, man of distinct long Holsteiner aristocratic lineage, and Francis Barty, Assistant Undersecretary in the Foreign Office, and also of aristocratic lineage, being the second son of the 6th Earl of Abingdon. But they didn't talk about aristocratic things. No, in their conversation, Bülow turned to Barty and said, "Why was it that in British commercial circles towards Germany, in British commercial circles, there was such ill feeling towards Germany?" Barty answered that Germany was very pressing and a successful rival, whose merchants had successfully challenged British commercial preeminence in the world, and that the German government subsidised German shipping lines, and German railways charged lower rates to exporters. And then he added, "Englishmen are bad at learning languages, whereas Germans are not. And young Germans, for the sake of learning English and getting on commercially, come to England and work as clerks at salaries on which Englishmen cannot live. And young Englishmen are consequently at a disadvantage, And the German commercial traveller, being a good linguist, has the advantage over his English rival. There you are. Pushy foreigners, cheap migrant labour, and monolinguistic Englishmen. That's the problem. So it was ever thus. And in the wake of the Brexit debate, I'm inclined to ask, does anything really change?
We have a very slight change to the planned order, simply because I'm told that one of the book's contributors, Sir Roger Carrick, is wanted to intervene but has to go at 7:15. So we wanted him to sort of intervene now before he had to go. So if Sir Roger, if you could possibly, are you moving? Are you coming to the front? Or yes, okay. If he could.
Well, thank you, Piers. Mine was the last chapter. They say the last shall be first, and I'm sorry to intervene. And I don't really want to speak at all, but I was asked to, and what diplomat refuses such a request? I learned a great deal from Professor Hamilton, whose work I recall a little in the Foreign Office. But I don't agree with absolutely everything he said, but we should have another debate another time. Firstly, may I commend LSE Ideas for that picture. That is in the Foreign Office. And that word commerce, over the years, as Professor Hamilton has illustrated, has not always been regarded as highly as it should. It is, ladies and gentlemen, panel, a rare privilege to be invited, and it was a rare privilege to be invited to contribute in a thoroughly non-academic way to a fine academic book. It was also a privilege to be helped, never directed, by three fine editors. The last chapter of this distinguished, if Piers evidently quite heavy, volume may or may not be reached by its readers. I'm impressed that Professor Hamilton has dipped into the last chapter. To write that was a really fine opportunity to try to explain what it feels like to pursue commercial diplomacy as part of the raison d'être of diplomats, which in my view is to work for the advance of the national interest. And that interest includes the whole gamut, political, consular, cultural, intelligence, military interests, and of course economic and commercial interests. And I bracket the two, as Professor Hamilton did to some degree. Diplomats, in my view, should always keep in mind such criteria for measuring their efforts as the creation and preservation of jobs in the UK economy. It's as basic as that. And in that last chapter, I tried to give examples of that particular pursuit. Commercial diplomacy has indeed a long and impressive and worthwhile history, but while it may have begun even with trading with the Phoenicians, and while it was given emphasis and extra effort under Queen Elizabeth I, it was probably in the 20th century that this book mainly addresses that it developed and became really very complex. During that century, it also suffered. It really did suffer as a discipline of British diplomacy by the vagaries of career fashions and the more instantly and exciting attractions of political diplomacy, which is usually indeed more exciting, if no more intellectually demanding, I would argue, than commercial work, and which often, I fear, but probably inevitably, and here's a key point, motivates British diplomats' political bosses, the secretaries of state, the ministers, and it motivates them historically and generally more than does commercial diplomacy. I'm glad to say, however, that in recent years, those political masters have themselves been instructed by number 10, been enjoined to add commercial diplomacy to their work, and to ensure that there is a commercial diplomatic element to all their official visits abroad. Realistically, that's often no more than stage signings of contracts that have been worked on for many years in some instances, and worked on very hard by both British businessmen and diplomats. Yet even that is a good thing, that ministers are involved in those signings. I will not keep this distinguished gathering longer, and I do have a last train to catch, which is absurdly early if you live in Exmoor. But I do hope, Chairman Piers and ladies and gentlemen, that the book being launched this evening, and in particular its very well researched, well argued, interesting and thoughtful academic chapters, will stimulate further work and will elevate the importance given nationally to the business of government support for business. And as a very last thought, roll on Brexit. I wish to God I hadn't been made to retire at an absurdly mandatory young age. Thank you very much.
Okay, so in that case, let's go on to James, your paper.
Well, you can tell Sir Roger worked in commercial diplomacy because he does make you want to buy the book, which I imagine at 600 pages almost is going to be beyond many people's pockets. So what I'm going to do, in contrast to Keith, is to try and summarise what it does for us as historians of the field. But first of all, I should say congratulations to the three editors, because this is no small task. There are 25 chapters spanning many different topics across many different areas across an extremely broad period of time. Those of us who've edited any work knows how hard that is. So congratulations to the three of you. I've often wondered why there has been no single volume on commerce and British foreign policy in the late 19th and 20th century before now. And I wonder if it's because historians, be they British or otherwise, have imbibed the social condition that exists in this country, which is that it's very rude to talk about money, or that they fear writing about commerce and economics involves technicalities which are beyond their own purview. As somebody who can claim to be self-taught on certificates of origin, customs, duties and tariffs, I can tell you it's not that threatening. I remember some of us great historian, Alan Millwood, once said that if you write about butter, you are writing about guns in a peaceful period. That's the only difference. Alan Dobson, who's written about both butter and guns, starts his chapter by writing this. In the 19th century, Britain became the modern trading nation par excellence and dominated the world's industry and commerce for decades. Well, while we know that to be true, if we consider the literature written on Britain's imperial history, for example, which is often dominated by the study of commerce and economics, we've not seen a sustained focus on these elements of Britain's foreign policy in the literature so far, which makes this book original by its very design. The reason for that perhaps might be found in Thomas Otter's chapter, when he said that trade mattered in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the Foreign Office if it was seen to have a, quote, general bearing on broader issues, which is essentially what Sir Roger's just been talking about, because it's true to say that in the perhaps the most dominant area in the last 30 years at least, which is the study of British foreign policy after 1939, the concentration of most historians has, of course, been on politicians, officials, and political diplomacy, not on commercial or economic diplomacy. If there has been focus, and I don't wish to caricature it too much, it's been in rather discrete areas, one of which is some of us have worked on in our own work, which is, of course, the relationship between Britain and the emerging process of European unity. What it does in 25 chapters is this book is establish without question the case for the study of commercial diplomacy and economic diplomacy in Britain's foreign relations from the late 19th century onwards. That just spills out of its chapters, and it does so in different ways. It's impressive in scope in terms of its contributions over time and geography and different historiographical approaches. Commerce and the FO is seen as a tool of diplomacy, but also as a driver of it. And the interplay between the two is very interesting. And it varies across space and time, as you would imagine it would, because commerce is not just one thing. Neither is economics. In fact, we learn much about what commerce was, from oil to nuclear civil relations, and as it was a genuine feature of British foreign policy during periods of war, as much as it was during periods of peace and Cold War. We also learn a lot in the many chapters about the Foreign Office's position in Whitehall on these matters. It's right to say, of course, that one of the reasons that historians haven't focused entirely on the Foreign Office and commercial diplomacy is because other bodies within Whitehall had responsibility for that, not least the Treasury, the Board of Trade, the DTI, overseas aid. All of these things emerge more significantly over the 20th century, and we learn a lot about those through the chronological span of the chapters in this book. Most impressively, for those of us who have been researching and teaching British foreign policy for a long while, what this book does is provide new work on areas of interest which have been relatively understudied by historians, especially historians of the Cold War. So whilst we have quite a bit of work on Britain's commercial and economic relations with its dominant allies in the West, and through the process of decolonization and the move towards Europe, we don't have it in many other areas. And of course, we're now thinking about those areas in ways that we haven't done before, because Britain will be necessarily concentrating on them as well as on Europe. Hence, we have chapters on Antarctica, on Asia, which is a much understudied area. Anthony Best's chapter on relations with China tells us not only about those relations, but also how power sat within Whitehall and the struggles between the Foreign Office and the Treasury, which is a constant theme in this work. We have good chapters on the Persian Gulf, a little known area really. We know a lot about it up until about 1968, but not thereafter, when Britain's special interest was described often in commercial and economic terms. We also have a specific chapter on Turkey. And whilst there is a lot of interest in 19th century British foreign policy in relation to the Ottoman Empire, there is not significant amounts of work on Turkey, or indeed the Balkans more generally in commercial terms, as the 20th century progresses. We also have specific chapters which mention Britain's role in commercial and economic terms in international institutions, about which we have to learn much, because Britain is just about to be setting sail amongst them. GATT, the non-military aspects of NATO, and the economic and commercial aspects of the United Nations. Ted Johnson's chapter on that goes to prove how little work there is, in fact, on those matters. The book also provides very good summaries of well-established areas of research and adds new work in those areas. Francine McKenzie's chapter on the Ottawa agreements of 1932, Effie's own work on Anglo-Italian relations. They're in familiar areas, but they add new views of them. We learn essentially much about commerce as a revenue producer, Richard Smith's work here. We learn about it in emerging markets, John's own work on South America, but not only his, Thomas Mills and others. And we learn a lot about specific commodities as overwhelmingly important strategic and commercial aspects. And amongst those, oil is perhaps the most dominant. And I have to say, and he's gone now, so it doesn't sound like I'm praising him, Roger Carrick's chapter is really interesting, because for those of us who have been working on foreign policy and diplomats over time, apart from some rather discreet memoirs, you don't get a lot of work written by diplomats involved in economic intelligence, commercial activity and economic relations. We learn about power relations, essentially, the questions that you raised at the end of your introduction, Keith, about where power sits in terms of economics and commerce, inside and outside of government, and how business and commercial interests sometimes had a role as executors of foreign policy, but sometimes also as informers and leaders of it. And as we increasingly think about where power sits in this country and how it will ensure that national interests are met, that jobs are sustained, it's important to think about these 25 chapters and what they tell us about Britain's global networks outside of Europe and the West, which is where we've tended to look at them so far.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John, if I can hand straight over to you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to keep my comments very brief. I realise that people have trains to catch and are possibly thirsty, or a combination of both. So I'd really just like to thank our speakers this evening. I always learn something when I listen to Keith and to James. And tonight is no exception. So thank you very much to them and to Piers for chairing this evening. One or two important substantive points have been raised, but I'm not going to address them. I think perhaps if we produce a second volume, this is just us limbering up. But there's a lot still to be said, but I think, so perhaps if that goes ahead, we can sort of address some of the substantive issues that have been raised. To reflect briefly on the origins of the book, well, that actually, it emerged, if you like, from the ashes of a stillborn project which Richard and I have been talking about, and it actually related to the experience of the Western Front, of British politicians. It unfortunately sort of crashed, but unfortunate and I'm pleased to say that this one didn't. What really drove me, and I think us, it's fair to say, as editors, was I think a genuine sense of inquiry. That's to say, I teach, I suppose, British interests in the Near East, in particular in the 19th century, and I always sort of am puzzled by the exact role of commerce, the role of commerce in British strategy more generally. So I thought it was really a sense of inquiry rather than of specific expertise, existing expertise, that sort of drew me to this subject. Broadly, I mean, James outlined very helpfully the scope of the volume, and I think we're all very pleased with the end result in terms of the geographical scope and the depth and range of issues that individual contributors brought to their chapters. And Richard has the credit for this, the two sort of leading questions that we invited our contributors to address, that's to say, what did the Foreign Office do to support British commerce overseas during the 20th century, and what did commercial interests do to influence British foreign policy, I think provided quite a useful framework for the volume. And I think broadly we were very happy that discussions cohered around those two issues. Finally, in terms of the content, I do want to thank Sir Roger again, because we were very, very pleased indeed to have a former very senior diplomat who had a lot of high-level experience of dealing with these issues contribute a chapter, and I would certainly commend his chapter as well as the others to you. I'd like to thank the contributors, some of whom are here this evening, for bearing with us over a five-year project. Also Molly Beck and Oliver Dyer, who are both here this evening on behalf of the publisher, Palgrave Macmillan. And lastly, LSE Ideas for their hospitality this evening. So thank you very much.
Effie, you were going to speak next.
Thank you, Pierce. Thank you to our brilliant commentators. Thank you for your very kind comments. They're deeply appreciated. I would like to thank LSE Ideas for hosting this event. In particular, I would like to thank Professor Mick Cox, Dr. Emilia Knight, Marta Kozielska, Astrid Hemper, and Joseph Barnsley, who worked very hard to make this event a success. And I would like to thank them for being such fantastic team and such great colleagues too. I would like to thank my co-editors, and I would also like to thank our brilliant contributors, because let's not kid about ourselves, without their work this book would never be able to come together. Thanks also go to Molly Beck, Palgrave, Molly Beck, Oliver Dyer, and John McCall of Emerald Publishing these days, who was the commission editor who commissioned the book. Now, I would like to say that this book had a very long gestation period, so it came out much later than we thought it would come out. So the manuscript really was submitted submitted before the Brexit referendum, much earlier than the Brexit referendum. So Brexit was not really in our thinking when this book came together. Our main objective was really to talk about economic and commercial diplomacy, because it has been somehow not been highlighted enough, and we thought that there was a serious gap in our understanding of how to approach British foreign policy, or how British foreign policy has been working. I mean, let's not forget what Younger the Pitt said. British foreign is trade, is foreign trade, so, and quite rightly so, this is an island nation. How else can it survive but through trade? There are two themes that struck me in particular when we were going through the contributions or when I came to write my own chapter. One was that both foreign and foreign economic and commercial policy have suffered a lot due to turf wars in the great departments of the state. That, I think, is my most abiding conclusion from this book. The other thing is the Brexit referendum did happen and certain decisions were taken. So that made me think that this book obviously is not a horizon scanner. It is not going to equip any politician to become more able to detect what Brodel described as the thin wisps of tomorrow. But I think it is quite useful when it comes to underline or highlight difficulties and to show the efficacy of some past policies. Thank you.
And last but not least of the panellists, Richard Smith.
Thank you, Piers. The problem with always going last on the panel is that everybody's already said everything that you're going to say in advance. But so I'll keep a comment short in the hope that people might want to ask some questions afterwards. But on this question of why we came to write the book, I mean, Keith talks about our impeccable timing just comes before Brexit. But as has been said before, that wasn't in our minds at all when we started to edit the book and put it together. People have talked about the long gestation period, but when we started, I had no children, and I've got two children. One of whom is at school. So,
too true.
That was a separate project.
Expensive.
Hopefully we're not going to have 25 children. but really, for me, the project started with the coalition government came into power in 2010, and they decided that they were going to have an export-led recovery out of the recession rather than borrowing. And they had this ambitious target to double British exports by 2020 from 500 million to 1 trillion. And I think David Cameron made a speech announcing this, and during the speech he called upon the FCO and diplomats to be more commercially minded and more commercially focused to help the government achieve this target. And I just wondered whether that was a bit of a kind of a lazy statement with a kind of Ferrero-Rocher view of diplomats doing nothing but drinking champagne and entertaining themselves in foreign capitals. And so I suppose really one of the aims was to unpick that statement and to see, well, exactly what have diplomats done for British trade over the last century? Has it changed at all? Where in government should responsibility for British economic and commercial work lie? Should those engaged in commercial work be specialists with distinct career paths, or should they be closely aligned to the diplomatic mainstream? And who drives commercial policy in Whitehall? So those were some of the kind of questions which we asked ourselves at the beginning of the process to try to get people to answer them. And I think out of that comes one of the key questions which Keith also raised, which is how should the government organise its commercial diplomacy? And when the book was finished, we made the point at the end of the introduction that things had come full circle, because the structure you had at the time was that you had UKTI, UK Trade and Investment, this non-ministerial government department which sat between the FCO and the Department for Business Innovation and Skills, and it was staffed by people from both departments, and it was responsible for export promotion abroad and getting inward investment. And this, to us, seemed to be harking back to a position earlier in the century where you'd had a Department for Overseas Trade, which sat between a Foreign Office and a Board of Trade as an organisation which tried to link these two departments' responsibilities together, because the Board of Trade was the department responsible for commercial policy, and yet the FCO had a very important role in promoting, using embassies overseas to promote trade in other countries. So the Department for Overseas Trade was to try to bring these, the work of the two departments together in a more efficient way. But, I mean, it was really, from the start, it was stillborn, and it was called a Mongol department, was one of the nice things that people said about it. And it came out of the First World War and a big debate about how economic work should be reorganised, you know, after the catastrophe of the First World War and the dislocation of Britain's trading networks. And, you know, Auckland Geddes, the Board of Trade, said that there should be a Department for Commerce, where you had the Board of Trade and the consular officials and all the commercial work which was done by the Foreign Office should be in a massive standalone Ministry for Commerce. But the British, you know, I don't know whether it's British pragmatism, decided that was, you know, too much of an extreme change, and so they decided for this compromise where they had the Department for Overseas Trade sitting in between the Foreign Office and the Board of Trade. So, you know, and we thought that the UKTI kind of harked back to that tradition. But now, since the book's come out, we've got a completely different government landscape where you've got the FCO and the Department for International Trade and the new, I think it's Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, I think is the title, but correct me if I'm wrong because they change so often these days. So you've got three departments, each with a different role in commercial promotion. And this, it seems to me now, we're harking back to the 1970s. This is the model from the 1970s, when you have a separate FCO, a separate Department for Trade, and a separate Department for Industry. And so I suppose, you know, how does the government organise its commercial diplomacy? Well, I don't think it's quite found. But it's obviously found a model for the moment that it wants to stick with. But over the course of the last century, you know, there hasn't been a definitive answer to that question, I don't think, and maybe there probably never will be. So I think I'll stop there. And yeah. Thank you, Piers.
Thank you. And may I say two words, please?
Sorry?
May I say something?
Yes, please do.
I would like to thank all of you for coming out here tonight to listen to us. And that's a very cold night, so that's... Thank you. And I would like, looking around this hall, I see the faces of many dear friends. And I feel very touched and very happy for that. Thank you very much.
We now have an opportunity to ask questions. We have about half an hour or so in order to do so. Can I start the ball rolling by sort of pitching a question which anybody, any of you, can leap in to answer? So it's a fairly general question, but don't all try and do so. Otherwise, we will never get out of here. But I suppose the first question I would ask, is a lot of the chapters do seem to emphasise the recurrent theme of turf war and the squabbles over the department, and Richard in his final interventions was talking about the constantly shifting sort of landscape of ministerial organisation in this field. I suppose my question is this any worse in the commercial area than elsewhere? Is this in a sense something that we would be talking about if we were discussing a volume about British development aid, or a volume about British nuclear policy, or a volume about any other aspect of British politics? Or is there something intrinsically difficult about commercial diplomacy which stimulates these kind of turf conflicts and problems?
Yes, Keith?
Looking
Looking back at my experience of the 1990s, and I'm thinking now when I was working on my book on the know-how fund on aid to Eastern Europe, one thing that did strike me about interdepartmental turf wars, one reason why they happened so frequently was because foreign relations is an area in which very often individual ministers can shine. They get more focus on them, more televisual appearances, more press attention. And it does very often seem to interfere with what embassies very often want to be doing. I mean, Michael Howard, for instance, I think it was at the Department of the Environment, I think, at one stage, was he? Or, no, perhaps not the Department of the Environment, but it was somewhere back in the early 1990s, and suddenly he wanted, as it were, to be signing documents in Moscow and what have you to do with British aid and British assistance policies. So you get a lot of complaints about that. And others too. You know, this is an area in which other departments can suddenly move into without having to take too much responsibility for what they do, but with getting a lot of light shining on them. So it's not just true of commerce. I think in modern times this is, it's generally true.
From my work, what has become clear is it all depends also on the personality of the foreign secretary. If you have a foreign secretary who has a vision and who knows where he wants to go and he understands the world like Bevin did. Bevin could see the Cold War rising when the economic departments could not see that. The economic departments were much more preoccupied, quite understandably, with making Britain tick and be able to survive. That is where really you come to have the big, big fights, because foreign policy cannot work without being able to oil the wheels through commerce, through trade, through deals. And if you have the economic departments having different priorities, then a turf war is going to explode in no time at all.
Okay. Thank you. Well, why don't I open the floor now to questions from the floor? Yes, straight away there's a hand at the back there, I see.
I was wondering whether your book and your research threw any light on whether to look at the issue of the mystery of what stops, say, a country such as Britain going to war, notwithstanding the national interest.
Gaynor Johnson, in her chapter, writes about the fact that the British business relationship that existed in Anglo-German relations in the 1930s existed outside of politics. So I'm not entirely sure. There are specialists on this that I don't know, but I don't think it's generally true that business would prevent conflict.
Can I? Yeah, I think to come back to what you were getting at. I think. You're not writing a thesis on Cobden or something, are you? Because, you know, one of Cobden's beliefs in the 19th century was that commerce produced peace. And I mentioned at the beginning of what I had to say about the volume, the exhibition in Buenos Aires. Well, the centenary of Argentine independence was also marked by Edward Grey, the foreign secretary, giving a speech at the Hotel Cecil. May the 25th, 1910, he gave it, in which he expressed a very Cobdenite view of relations with Argentina, in which he said, Britain's relations with Argentina is one purely of commerce. Politics do not intrude into it. Therefore, it's a purely peaceable relationship. And I think that is a doctrine that did prevail inside the British diplomatic community, that those countries that you had pure commerce with were not countries that you had conflict with. Whether that, on the other hand, could be turned around and say, does this mean that commerce prevents you going to war, I think that's another matter. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who felt it before 1914 that because commercial relations were so tight between, say, the European countries, they could never afford to go to war. But, of course, they did.
Okay, yes.
Just adding a point to that, Lord Haldane, in March 1914, at the Crichton Lecture, announced that there was less danger of war between Britain and Germany than there had been at any time in previous decades because the commercial relationship between the two was so close. Mm. That was one of the poorer Crichton lectures.
And may I just add that Victor Wellesley, when he started off that memorandum that I quoted earlier, actually said that the war had come about in 1914 because of economics and because Britain was moving towards a situation where it would have imperial preference would be introduced and Germany would be shut out of global trade, and therefore Germany had to go to war before that happened.
Okay, further questions? Yes, okay. Again, there's the microphone, you can head that way.
I was just wondering, a lot of has been made, and I think rightly, about the fact that this book fills a big gap, and not a lot of work has been done on this. And I'm sort of interested, because if you actually look at the archive, there's a lot of material there. Mm. And I'm just interested in, there sort of seems to be two sides of this. One is that the Foreign Office at times and in certain eras and in certain individuals seems not interested in it. And the other side is that actually a lot of the time you think, well, historians don't seem particularly interested in it. And I just wondered if you could perhaps shed some light on what you think is more important in that sort of dichotomy between whether or not this is something which the FCO or FO is not actually interested in, or whether historians as a community have actually just missed this.
So is it our fault or the diplomats? Who wants to go? Effie?
That's a very good question, actually. It is the fault of both, I think. Political diplomacy is supposed to be sexier than commercial diplomacy as far as diplomats are concerned. Now, as far as historians are concerned, the pitfall is the FO 371 series, which for me, it is one of the best catalogued series in the whole wide world. And once you've hit it, or the FCO's other series, you feel very comfortable there. And you really do not want to veer outside. My interest in commercial diplomacy and economic diplomacy was forced upon me by the Stevenson professor in this august institution, Professor Donald Cameron Watt. He used to be the Stevenson Chair in International History for nearly two decades. And one day he took me aside and he said, "You cannot really get the measure of British diplomacy through the FO 371 alone. You have to go out and look at the Treasury files and the Board of Trade files." And that's what I did. And then I realized that, yes, he was absolutely right. And diplomacy is a multi-layered, multifaceted approach. You cannot only have political diplomacy, then it would be all war, I suppose.
Yes, well, can I come back? Because I agree with what you were actually saying. I mean, I think it is the problem with historians rather than the Foreign Office in this sense. I think that, but you see, how many people here have heard of the Newfoundland fisheries dispute? How many people know that the Anglo-French Entente of the 8th of April 1904 was almost wholly about the Newfoundland fisheries dispute? You can read any of the great books on the coming of the Entente Cordiale. Read Christopher Andrew, his early work on that subject. Del Casse and the Entente Cordiale. I think the Newfoundland fisheries gets a footnote. And yet, what occupied more time and more attention of diplomats trying to negotiate that Anglo-French Accord than the Newfoundland fisheries dispute? It wasn't settled in 1904. It went on and on and on and on. It was still going on in the 1920s. What about the Tangier International Sanitary Commission?
one of the great unsettled issues of diplomacy. These issues were important. People moaned and groaned in the Foreign Office about the way in which we were treated by the Spaniards and the French on the International Sanitary Board of Tangier. You know, we almost got to war with the French at one stage in 1913 over this. But no, it's boring, isn't it? I think that you look at these numerous files on commerce, and very often people just do not want to attempt them. I think, you know, historians very often complain about the lack of interest in the 19th century Foreign Office in commerce, but really what it comes down to is the lack of historical interest in 19th century commerce. It is a British problem, however. If you look at French historians, look at, say, the work of someone like Raymond Poidemin, who did a marvellous book on Franco-German commercial and economic relations and finance. Jacques Barietti, a whole series of French historians I could give you, who have done marvellous work on economic diplomacy in the 19th and 20th century. It is very much, perhaps not a British, it's an Anglo-Saxon flaw, I think.
If I can just add a footnote on that, I think one of the other issues is simply that so many historians are scared of numbers, that they don't want to do anything where there are going to be lots of statistics and lots of business figures, etc. I've seen the effect on conferences of historians of somebody who does know how to manipulate numbers, and people just run away because this is a terrain on which they do not want to fight. And I think that has quite a lot to do with it as well.
Yes, Richard. Just to add one point, I'd agree with what Keith said. I've got a quote from Harold Nicholson. It's always good to have a quote from Harold Nicholson about diplomacy. And when the Foreign Office lost out to the Department for Overseas Trade and lost commercial work after the First World War to the Department for Overseas Trade, Harold Nicholson said that the new commercial service allowed diplomats to rid themselves of an embarrassing and somewhat uncongenial task to which they knew themselves unfitted. So I suppose if diplomats of the day were bored by commercial work, it's maybe not surprising that historians have similarly not picked up the challenge of dealing with it in a rigorous way.
Okay, further questions? We have a microphone. We have no questions. Oh, yes, here at the front. The microphone is on its way.
Thank you. Very happy to be LSE Ideas. I'm an alumni here and haven't been here for a while. And what brought me here, these amazing issues of economic diplomacy. And he should mention UKTI, and the great campaign was what brought me to UK. I used to work in a foreign country, and I was like absolutely in love with the campaign. And that was a very strong way to promote UK image outside, abroad. And, I know that the book is about history, is not current affairs, but if you don't mind, maybe just mention something about nowadays and how things are going, because the way of UK spread its message, not only throughout Latin America, but also Eastern European countries, and I've been working at the time quite close to the local embassies, and I was really innovative, of course, creative and marketing as well. But and now?
Well, I should say that I don't work on commercial diplomacy within the Foreign Office. I'm a historian there. But, the Great Campaign, one of the three priorities of the Foreign Office is prosperity, so doing everything that it can to promote British business and in turn British jobs. And the Great Campaign, Keith mentioned things like History Weeks. British Weeks. they used to have in the 1960s and the 1970s, where they go to a particular country and they would try to promote British business to that particular country or cities within that particular country. And I suppose the Great Campaign is similar to that, but it's global in scale and it's all the time. It's not just happening on a particular week in a particular country in a particular year. And it also tries to bring in not just business and industry and investment, but also a cultural aspect as well, I think, and its reach is much wider than just industry and commerce, but reaches to all the creative industries in the UK, and you know, culturally as well as economically. So, yeah, I mean, I think the I mean, the government at the moment is, you know, promoting global Britain, so Brexit isn't seen as being a contraction, but it's seen as being, you know, Britain is still globally engaged with Europe and elsewhere. Of wanting to promote itself on the global stage. So I think you know, the campaign will continue after Brexit. In fact, it's probably even more important after Brexit to keep those global connections renewed.
Okay, further questions?
It's quite amazing that you brought up the fisheries and how boring it was, because a similar case happened in 2011 when the European Commission was due to renegotiate the renewing of the fisheries partnership agreement with Morocco, and it brought the grounds of the parliament to a halt because obviously it was the French and the Spanish that wanted the agreement and the rest did not because of the damage that was creating for the whole union. But what lessons are there to learn from what we've seen? And I guess I haven't read the book yet because it's launching today, but what lessons are there that can be learned now that the UK is going to take a new direction in which it doesn't have to have the agreement of France and Germany to be able to do any trade agreement under the EU Commission and the Council, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you.
Okay, who wants to take on the post-Brexit future?
I'll have a start.
I thought you would.
I'll give it a go. I don't think there is an answer. It's a great question. You know, I was trying to think as I was coming over here, skipping through the book again, having read it already, what a policymaker would want to do with it, because it's 600 pages long. They'd want six, max. Mm. So we can all probably, you know, or two, we can all probably contemplate what it would say. Well, Richard's chapter on export promotion in Iran in the 70s, it's a post-imperial, a new kind of European-centered commercial policy in a part of the world where Britain has historic ties but troubled political relations, which is about to emerge into a new religiously based regime, which makes it very difficult to navigate, especially when international institutions are conditioning what Britain can do overseas, namely Britain's membership of the European community, and where Britain's fortunes economically are at best variable in the 1970s. I think that's a pretty good basis for thinking about where we are right now. The difference, of course, is that in much of the period we've seen in this book, Britain is either a dominant international power, you know, the trading nation par excellence, as Dobson says, or part of a large market within an international architecture of institutions which is protected from the worst buffets of capitalism or its anarchy. Mm. If Britain's floating alone, if we say have a hard Brexit, which is feasible, the lessons of this book are that it's going to be difficult for Britain to maintain its commercial advantage in a market which is driven by interdependence or global hegemons, I would say, and that despite the acuity of commercial actors within the Foreign Office, you can only fight with what you've got to fight with. And global Britain, of course, is necessary, but the reality of power is yet more important, sadly.
Yeah. I mean, I would say on that question, actually, that I think that perhaps we're not the right people to be asked that question. It does remind me of when, I think it was 2003, and I was in the Foreign Office, and there was a move then, all departments and sections of the office ought to be more forward-looking, planning what they were doing in the future. And there was a great request, everybody had to form a foresight committee. I remember my protest that I was a historian and thought I ought to be on a hindsight committee didn't go down for that.
No, but it is a really good question. Maybe the answers could speak.
It is,
well.
Yes.
Yeah. Thinking of that reminds me, back in 1995, I went out, one of the first UK academics to go out to Lebanon at the end of the war, the conflict there. One of the first ones, certainly, who was not an archaeologist. And I was invited out by a student at SOAS, for whom I still had some responsibility in completing her PhD, and she had a very senior political background. And I found myself being assailed by various ministers saying, why isn't Britain here? You know, yes, you're coming out and you're talking these nice things on gender equality. We're awfully glad to see you. But why isn't Britain here? Why isn't the embassy more interested in doing something with us, encouraging the businessmen out? We don't want the Germans. We don't want the French. We're cross with the French for varying reasons. We're cross with the Americans for various reasons. We'd love the British to come out. Now, how far does this book reveal that one of the things that is a complexity, past and present, in British commercial foreign policy is the fact that we don't actually understand where we might be welcome, at least when an opportunity arises, if we have not traditionally been involved in that region?
That's a very good point.
Who would like to respond?
If I could elaborate on both of these questions, if I don't mind, very briefly, I don't want to hog it, but it struck me that one of the things that the book tells us, and this is true of many chapters actually, is that the Foreign Office sometimes develops expertise through its commercial arms and its relations with other Whitehall departments who specialise in these matters. But it's the business and commercial interests who often know what's going on the ground. And some of the chapters make the point that commerce and business drives foreign policy ultimately, in that the diplomats listen to those commercial and business interests involved overseas and accommodate policy around them to try and improve export revenues or create an import drive or whatever. As you can see, I'm not one of the historians who can add up and write. But nevertheless, it's true to say that business involvement in foreign policy is clearly one of the things which has come through many of the chapters here. And also making strategic priorities about what Britain's strategic priorities are in the first place, in a real sense, not one that's politically imbued. So a cold heart, what the Marxist historians would call the true facts of history.
No. Actually, I would like to comment. Both questions are very, very, very good. And it is quite interesting, actually, that from my perspective, most of the time, the British do not realize where they're going to be most welcomed. And when they think that they are going to be welcomed in a country, let's say Italy, the Americans have supplanted them, and they cannot be influential. It is really very difficult to be able to determine where you're going to be most welcome. And I agree with James. Actually, your best intelligence will come from local businesses. They're the only people who can help you. But the other problem, however, is that commercial foreign policy is not the province of one department. The Foreign Office will not really be, although the Foreign Office has a very rounded picture, there are departments that always undermine its attempts to create a better environment in certain countries. And that is a bind there most of the time.
Probably one final question. There was a gentleman at the back who has had his hand up.
I was just going to ask about the areas in which foreign policy stops commerce, be it for ethical, moral grounds or whatever. And I'm thinking of a couple of specific instances, for example, the arms embargo on Israel or trade with South Africa in the late 70s and 80s onwards. Does the book shed any more light on such instances?
Who wants to intervene on that?
I don't think the book gives any specific examples, but it does raise an interesting dilemma in that quite often, you know, the juiciest things that Britain has to export, they could be, say, high technology items, you know, advanced technology. It's quite often thing, and there are countries that want to buy them, but they're not countries that you might necessarily want to sell them to. You know, during the Cold War, you might not want to sell certain items to the Soviet Union or to Eastern Europe, no matter how much they would want to buy them. So It does raise that interesting dilemma that, you know, there's an opportunity there to sell stuff, and, you know, if, like Britain, you rely on exports for your standard of living, then it's very tempting. But you have to balance that against, you know, the negative strategic downside if those countries, you know, got hold of those items. Might give them a competitive industrial military advantage. So, you know, that dilemma does come across in several of the chapters in the book. And Britain certainly pushes the boundaries more than, say, the Americans do in trading during the Cold War with the Soviet bloc. The Americans are very reticent, you know, about allowing any high technology to get through to the Soviets, but the British are, you know, push the boundaries a bit more on that.
Anybody else want to intervene on that? Well, in that case, we probably do have a chance to squeeze one more final question in, if there's any takers. Well, if there aren't, in that case, I would suggest that we adjourn to the reception, which is straight outside, where you can have a glass of wine, etc. But before we should do so, I think we should thank all the speakers in the usual way.